Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Hashtag No Limits. Hashtag No Limits is about people whose society has placed limits upon, but who have busted through those limits. Ophelia says in Hamlet, we know who we are, but not who we will be. And I believe that to be 100% true, and that there is not a more beautiful example than the caterpillar turning into the butterfly. For those who don't know, the caterpillar literally dissolves into cells and then reforms into the butterfly. And if that wasn't difficult enough, it has to struggle in the cocoon and to fight its way out with its wings, basically, for its wings to be strong enough for it to fly and take it wherever it's supposed to soar to. None of that can be easy, I'm sure, but neither is busting through the limits that society places upon a person. And today's topic is a topic that is a difficult topic to talk about. It's not difficult, it's uncomfortable. This is an uncomfortable topic to talk about whether you have a neurotypical or a neurodiverse child. It's uncomfortable to talk about in most settings. And so I'm really excited to have Catherine sort of gently navigate us through this topic today and hopefully give you some ideas and ways to talk with your child, whether they're adult age or teenage age, whether they're neurodiverse or neurotypical. So I haven't told you what the topic is yet, but Catherine, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for inviting me.
Awesome. I'm so glad you're doing well. And I love that blue. It's a really nice color on you. So a couple housekeeping things. I always forget this part because I'm always anxious to get to the guest. If you are watching, do exactly what my friend Fran has done here and let us know, hashtag live, and where you're watching from. Hi, Fran. Thanks for joining us today. And if you're watching in the replay, instead of live, say hashtag replay. And if you have any questions or comments for Catherine or myself while the live is going on, go ahead and pop those into the chat. I'll be able to put them up just like I have Fran's. If it's in the replay, I'll make sure that Catherine gets them. All right. I think that takes care of housekeeping. So Catherine, what is this uncomfortable topic that we're going to be discussing today?
Well, we're going to be talking about sexuality. So how do we talk to our young and grown children about sexuality and healthy relationships? And I think one of the things when we hear the word sexuality, we immediately think SEX, sex. And that, yeah, that's something, that's a part of it, but there's so much more to it than that. And really it's about relationships and even our gender and sexual orientation, all of our relationships that we're in, feeling connected to others and close with others. Those are all aspects of our sexuality, our self-esteem. So we're sexual beings from birth to death, and that doesn't mean that we're having sex. It means that we have a sexuality, and we all have a sexuality.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, I've only had to raise, had the privilege to raise one child. And I remember, you know, having the talk about the SEX, but throughout her life, there were the littler talks. Mm-hmm. And I have a feeling that what we're going to be discussing today has a lot more to do with the littler talks than it does with that big one. Although, as you said, that big one is part of it. Mm-hmm. So how did you end up doing this? Yeah. I don't imagine you sitting around going, okay, I think this is what I'm going to do now.
Yeah. So I originally started as a community educator for Planned Parenthood. And in that capacity, I was going into schools, I was working with parents, I was working with professionals. And this, a lot of special educators and developmental disability agency staff started to reach out looking for some help. How do you address this topic? People felt really unclear and unsure about how to approach it. So that was happening. And at the same time, I also ended up in my mid-20s, I experienced an accident where I started to use a wheelchair. So I started to see, oh, people are treating me differently now that I wheel around the world instead of walking around the world. Well, that's interesting. I'm the same person. So I started to become you know, more interested in disability awareness, and I was working around sexuality and sexual health education. And so they kind of all those things together led me down this path. And I think, like you said, it's not that it's necessarily a difficult topic to talk about, but we don't have a lot of role models. What we see in our culture is don't talk about it, or we joke about it. But no one really has seen how do you have like a normal, healthy conversation about this topic. We don't have a lot of models for that. I've even had parents say to me, can you just answer a question so I can see, like, so I can hear what a healthy, normal conversation sounds like?
Yeah. And I don't know if, I know we talked about different videos that we might show throughout today if there's time, but that's a great point, because sometimes I do think when our kids start asking us questions, or they are feeling like they're a certain way other than what society says should, you know, is that way, that they're just curious. They're just, I'm not sure how this feels. I'm not sure where I should go with this thought or this feeling. And just us as adults, not jumping to one extreme or the other, and, you know, not saying, oh, you know, that's not how you're feeling, or totally, you know, yes, this is how you're going to feel, and you're going to feel this way for the rest of your life. None of our feelings are that way. And so being able to have some, all right, well, let's talk about this, you know, let's have a discussion about this.
Yeah.
You know, and so if you could kind of, whether there's a video for that, or if you could just kind of walk us through like some tips that you would give, I don't want you to give out your whole, suitcase full of information, but just a few little tips.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think tips are really helpful for people. I think in general, for parents, what we want to do is really think about, you know, what kind of message do we want to give about the topic? And I think that's where I often start with parents. Like, what messages did you get growing up about sexuality? And I oftentimes during trainings will do a poll, and the number one, the highest one usually is, don't talk about it. Rarely do, you know, maybe a handful of people will say that they got some positive messages about sexuality. As a culture, we're pretty fear-based around the topic. In the movie Mean Girls, I don't know if you saw the movie or know the scene, but the phys ed teacher says, if you have sex, you will get chlamydia and you will die. And so, right. And, you know, not true. But we often, the way we teach about the topic is we're teaching in a way to try to get people not to. So let's make them afraid. Let's show a birth, you know, after you watch a birth on a video, and you don't really want to do much of anything after that. Right. So
right, yeah.
We try to discourage it. And, so my first tip to parents and professionals too, is to, give positive messages, you know, like, this is a normal part of growing up, and no wonder you have questions. Because right. we want to be the ones they talk to. Yep. I often will say to parents in particular, if we don't teach healthy sexuality, someone else or something else is going to teach unhealthy. So don't we want to be part of these conversations where we can share our values as parents? And for professionals, it's more of a, you know, just to help people have factual information so they can make good choices in their lives.
Yeah. And I think there's so much in society right now that is emotion-based. Mm-hmm. And I think that going back to factual information, and honestly, I mean, when we had these discussions with our daughter, I mean, my husband and I talked about it. And of course, like you said, we wanted to instill our values in her. And we did. We, you know, we bought the books, different books from organizations, you know, that had developmentally appropriate pictures. Mm-hmm. and I think that's very important. because some, you know, I mean, I think there are levels where things are way above understanding or they're too childish. Mm-hmm. So, you know, finding that right level. And we, as uncomfortable as we were, we knew it was important for the exact reason you said. If we didn't teach her the way that of our values, of our beliefs, you know, the way that we understand how God made us, and that, you know, other people were going to teach her directly, but more so indirectly, and shape that viewpoint.
Right.
But having the facts, like, and I didn't know, you know, if that was me as a teacher, because I was used to teaching, you know? And so that was an easy concept for me to grasp, like, you know, things are difficult, things are uncomfortable, but if we don't talk about them, if we don't discuss them, that's not helpful. And so I guess I was more willing maybe to be uncomfortable than other parents might be.
Maybe. Yeah. 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 And I think when I look at the positives of talking to your own child or, you know, learning about this topic, there's so many benefits for people with disabilities or people without disabilities, you know, having the information, there's so many benefits to that. And the downside is it's uncomfortable for you as the parent or the professional, but for them, it's really helpful. And there's so many benefits. The downside, like I said, is it's awkward, right? And
right.
Yeah. So I think, yeah, that's more about us. And if we're really wanting to support others, then that, you know, the benefits go towards them.
Right.
I think too, just, you know, knowing that it's okay to feel embarrassed as well, as another tip. You know, we're not used to talking about this and we might blush a little bit when we do. And all we have to do is say, you know, I didn't talk with my parents much about this. And it's kind of, you know, it's so private and all that. And I feel a little funny, but I'm so glad we're talking about it. So you're giving that message around, this is important. Even if it's awkward, this is important.
Right. So one of the things that I remember doing is oftentimes our littler talks, and honestly, even the bigger talks, I would have those more often than not while driving.
Mm-hmm.
and so we didn't have to look at each other.
Yeah.
Because I think that's a big part of the awkward. Is that something that you recommend, or do you recommend the just sitting and talking?
Yeah. I mean, I think that so many parents talk about the driving in the car and they're in the front seat and the child's in the back or next to them and there's no eye contact. And then I've also had young people tell me, oh gosh, every time, you know, we're in a long car ride, I know my mom's going to bring something up.
Sure.
So, you've got them captured. Right.
But
I think you're right. I think it's difficult to look face to face and talk about really private things. And also, like you said, there's a lot of little talks. So I think a lot of that are these teachable moments that we have in our lives. And this idea of the talk, that it's one and you just check it off your list and you're done. There's so many talks to have, and there's so much in the culture that we can comment on. And if we're watching a movie with some, you know, our loved ones, we can talk about the relationship, what we didn't like, or what did you think about that? And so there's so many conversations where we're sending messages. And I know when I have two children who are in their 20s now, but I remember when they'd ask a question, I would think, what's the message I want to give about this? Mm-hmm. And just, you know, that it's a positive, you know, a positive message that's supportive. And I'm thought of as someone you can go to so that I'm not going to overreact. I'm not going to yell at them for asking the question. You know, if they have a question, they can come to me. And that's, you know, a lot of the resources talk about becoming an askable parent, where you're one that your child can go to and ask questions, and you're not going to freak out and flip out and think that they're having sex or anything. Just give factual, calm, matter-of-fact information.
And that is so important, I think, to remain calm and to, you know, like, as you just said, you know, it just be prepared. I mean, even if the child comes to you at 5 or age six and says, "Mom, where do babies come from?" or "Dad, where do babies come from?" Ask them a question. Don't assume that they really are asking you.
Yes.
The technical version, you right. know, or "Where did I come from?" Right. You know, ask them, "What do you mean by that?" You know, because of course, as a parent, our mind automatically goes, "Oh my gosh, you know, they already want to know about this stuff." And maybe that yep. might be truly what they're mm-hmm. asking. But in my experience with all the different kids that I've worked with in my life and been involved with, more often than not, that's not what they're asking. Right. And so whether it is or isn't the point right now, but ask those questions like, "Well, what do you mean?" Or, you know, "What brought up that question?" Yes. You know, what, and as you said, in a non-freaked out way, in a non-accusing way, just in that, and I'm sorry, I feel like I'm the one giving the advice here. So tell me if any of this is incorrect.
No, this is great advice. I'll add to it. Go ahead.
But yeah, I mean, I think it's just like anything, you know, it's a behavior, it's a curiosity. Behavior is communication. So what are they trying to communicate by asking that question? What are they really wanting to know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And there's different models you can use, but the one that I use is from the Center for Sex Education. And the first thing is, you know, give positive messages like, "I'm so glad you asked that. What a great question." So you're sort of encouraging this. And then the second step is what you're saying, you know, where did you hear that? Or what do you know about that word? So I think in some ways it just gives you more information. And there's different videos online about like a little girl saying to her mom, "What's virgin mean?" And the mother goes into this whole thing about sex and all, right. And then the child says, "Oh, well, what does that have to do with olive oil?" Right. So you want to say, right? You see? Well, it's on the olive yeah. oil bottle. And then you say, "Oh, well, yeah. that means," right. So
yeah.
you're sort of checking out where this word came from, where the question might've come from. What's the real question here? Then we decide the messages we want to give, and we answer, you know, calmly and matter-of-factly. And then we also want to ask, you know, "Do you have other questions?" Or with children with intellectual or developmental disabilities, we might check for learning too. Like, "Teach me what I just taught you. So you teach me, we just talked about what blah, blah, blah meant. Now you teach me." So you can check for yeah. learning as well. So but I think when we get a question, there's, like you said, like, you know, it's almost shocking. And so this is a way to go, "That's such a great question." And it calms you down a little. "Tell me where you heard it," or "Tell me more about that." And, you know, it just slows it down where we're, you know, when we get the question, we think we have to have the perfect answer just like thrown right out, and we can slow down and think about it. We can come back to it later. You know, "That's such a good question. And I want to think about how I want to explain that to you. So give me a few minutes and I'll come back to you." We can do that. It's okay. We don't have to know everything and put pressure on ourselves. So we can just surround it with "Great question." Try to find out what they want. And then we can even, you know, we can even say things like, "That's such a great question. We're in a public place at the grocery store, and this is a right. private topic. So let's wait till we get some privacy." So we're just kind of setting boundaries around the topic as well. And always going back to it, you know, not saying, "Well, let's not talk right. about it. This isn't a good place," and then never going back to it.
Right.
But it's okay right. to talk about it at another time.
And I think that's very important. And I think it's sometimes not intentional when we say, "Okay, this isn't the place. We'll talk about it later." And we forget. Sometimes, though, it is intentional, like, "I'm going to tell them we're going to talk about it later," and then we're not. Because
yeah.
what that does is, if you don't talk about it with them, they're going to go find an answer someplace else.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, again, you know, you're not able to then teach them from your perspective as their parent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I think of, It seems like this particular topic is one that parents do feel they have to have all the answers immediately, because I don't feel that when I would go to my parent and ask them for help with my studies in school, or, you know, if I was to say to them, you know, hey, when I got into my teenage years and was able to drive, how do I get from here to Chicago? Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to go and seek out other resources because they're not going to know,
exactly.
You know, but for whatever reason, and there's an okay with them not knowing those other things. But for some reason, when it comes to sexuality, we as parents, we have this like, oh, I got to know the answer right now. And I can't, you know, and I think that might come from just the shock of it.
Mm-hmm. You
know, our brain's going, oh, fight, yeah. Flight, or freeze. What do I do?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's part of it. This, you know, yeah, that we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to know everything about it. And so how do we give parents resources so they can look things up, and I'll show a couple of different resources that might be helpful as well.
Okay.
And I see.
So we do have Fran asking a question. How do you help a neurodiverse individual understand the consequences of having sex?
Yeah. Well, I think the first thing we want to do is define what sex means, and you know, it can be different for different people, but really what we want to focus on is that sex is usually thought of as vaginal sex, oral sex, or anal sex. And so that's what we mean when we're talking about sex. And then we might talk about what are the different consequences, what can happen if you had vaginal sex. And that's when you're talking more about reproduction and there's ways to prevent pregnancy. And then we also want to talk about sexually transmitted infections. And there's all kinds of consequences, right? Maybe somebody isn't interested in you anymore after that. You know, all kinds of things can happen. I'm thinking that's what you're talking about, is sort of the, if you decide to be sexual with another person, here are some things to think about.
And I think that's a great point that you just brought up, that oftentimes is not what we consider as a consequence. We will consider, well, if you have vaginal sex, you could get pregnant.
Yeah.
And we don't think about the emotional consequence. Mm-hmm. And I think that is huge. And I'm so thankful that you reminded me and the audience of that, because there is such a huge toll on the emotions.
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really just looking at if you choose to do this, what are the possible things that could happen? And there's all kinds of things, and there could be really positive things too. So what are some positive things that could happen when you're sexual with another person? And what are some negative things that could happen? And young people usually have ideas about that, you know, it might impact my, you know, friendships, it might impact the relationship, it might impact, I might become pregnant. So I think young people have a sense of that as well. And then, you know, the one thing that many, I work with a lot of people who call themselves self-advocates, so people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and they often say, that they talk to their parents and they say, you need to let me make mistakes. That's how I learn. That's how I grow. But it's scary, right? When some of the consequences right. could be really painful for an
right.
individual. But that's advice from people with disabilities around, you know, let me, you know, you can't protect me from everything.
Right.
And part of life is making mistakes, and I want to learn from them and grow from them. But it's hard because a child might be struggling in all kinds of ways, and we don't want to make their life more complicated as well. But I also think too that there's a lot of myths about talking about sexuality too. So, yeah, I'll comment on that in a second. But I was going to say that there's a myth that if you talk about sexuality with your children, it'll give them ideas and they will do it. And it's just not true. And research shows that as well, that when there's strong parent-child communication about the topic, young people are less likely to have sex And if they do, more likely to use protection. So it has positive health outcomes. And Fran, you say the mistakes are carried by more than
the individual.
Yeah. What do you mean by that? I think I know, but if you have like a boy and a girl might get pregnant if they had vaginal, is that what you mean? Or what do you mean by not just the individual?
Yeah, it'll take a second because there's a little bit, even though I told the algorithm to, you know, let me know when the comment immediately comes up. It always takes a few seconds. And so while she is talking about that, I do want to, it's on the same lines. When we're talking about sex and making sure that, and I know this is the title of the one video that you had showed me that you might share with us, is the consent piece.
Yeah. And,
but it's not even the, you said the advocate said to allow them to make mistakes.
Yes.
So the consent piece we'll come back to. So I'll go ahead and let you respond to Fran.
Yeah. So, I still am not totally clear what you're saying.
When I think what she might be saying is when you were talking about the self-advocates with the developmental disabilities are saying to their parents, I have to make my mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so allowing them to make those mistakes, when they make that mistake, it's not, you know, it could be the parent who's also responsible. It could be the other parties are involved in that mistake. I think, is that what you're talking about, Fran?
Yes. That makes sense to me now yes, they might be able to make mistakes, but those mistakes impact other people. I think, especially if we're talking about a pregnancy, right? That absolutely. And I think that what I often will ask parents too, is what worries you about talking with your child about sexuality or them learning about this topic? And usually what comes up is fear of sexual abuse or being taken advantage of or getting hurt or your child hurting someone else or taking advantage of someone else. So that tends to be the big worry for a lot of parents in particular. And I think just this idea of bodily autonomy, which I was going to show you, I'll show that video on consent. It's actually for young kids, but I think the messages are really good for all of us, including adolescents and adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities as well. But I think it's a nice one, especially if you have young children, you can use it to show kids about it's your body and you get to decide what's right for you. And my experience is that when I'm teaching classes of people with disabilities, they haven't learned that yet. They've learned along the way to do what authority tells them to do. They don't have they don't have a choice. And that's true to some degree. You know, if you're in school and the teacher says it's time to go to the cafeteria,
right,
you do have to go to the cafeteria, right? There's some time.
Right.
But as far as who touches your body and your body, that's up to you. And so I'd love to show this video now. Just to show an example to Fran and anyone else that might be watching of part of sexuality education is teaching bodily autonomy. And so I'll play this and we will see what you all think.
Consent for kids. This is you. Okay, it doesn't look exactly like you, but let's say it's you. This is your body, and you get to decide what you do with your body. No one else is entitled to tell you what to do with your body. Not your friends, not strangers, not adults you know. No one is entitled to decide what you do with your body. Except you. That's called bodily autonomy, by the way. And that's what consent is all about. Everyone is different. Some people love to hug. And some people hate hugs. And each person gets to decide what they're comfortable with. Can a hug-loving person just start hugging someone at random? Nope. They need consent. How do people know if they have consent? They ask. Would you like a hug?
Yes, I would. Can I hold your hand?
I'd rather not.
Okay.
If a person doesn't say yes...
Can I hug you?
Then they haven't given their consent. It's really pretty simple. Ask for consent, listen to the answer. By the way, if a person bribes someone or threatens someone to say yes, that's not consent. Sometimes adults will try to tell a kid what to do with their body.
Go kiss Aunt Doris goodbye.
But the kid still gets to decide. No thanks, that makes me uncomfortable. I'll just wave goodbye. Some things kids can't consent to. They can't enter into legal contracts. They can't vote. And they can't consent to sexual stuff. Because they're kids. So if an adult does something that kids can't consent to, that's not okay. The adult is wrong, and it's not the kid's fault. And that's when it's most important to tell a trusted adult, like a teacher. Why? Because it's your body. And no one else is entitled to tell you what to do with it. Practice consent.
All right.
That is really, really awesome. I love the fact that it talked about hugs and kisses. And I learned that, thankfully, when our daughter was really little. And so even with my nieces and nephews, you know, I'll still get people, you know, oh, give Aunt Shelley a hug goodbye or kiss goodbye. And they're, you know, and they kind of, and I'm like, that's okay. We can, like you said, we can high five, we can knuckle, we can shake hands, do whatever. Mm-hmm. But I think parents are embarrassed when their kids don't want to give that hug or that kiss, and they don't understand the future ramifications of forcing their child, and it's not a guaranteed ramification, so a potential ramification of forcing their child to hug and kiss their grandparents or their aunts and their uncles or whomever.
Yep.
And it's something that I talk about when I do my trainings on understanding behaviors. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it before we started to watch the video. Do you know the statistical number of how many times more likely someone who is neurodiverse has to be sexually assaulted or abused than the typical person?
Yeah. So there's different studies that have different results, but the more recent one is that people with intellectual and developmental disabilities are 7 times more likely to be sexually abused.
Oh, gosh, and if it was that high.
A female with intellectual and developmental disabilities, 12 times more likely. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah, so there's the statistics are staggering. And, the reason that people with disabilities are targeted is they appear to be vulnerable, or they appear to be uneducated and unaware, and people will describe them as the perfect victim. And so giving that knowledge to young people, understanding their body as their own, all of those pieces help reduce the risk. I mean, the reason abuse happens is the abuser abuses, right? It's not right. Anybody's fault. But there are certain things that might make somebody a little more vulnerable. And if you're looked at as vulnerable, easy to take advantage of, then you might be targeted. And so to me, knowledge is power. Knowledge is education. Knowledge is protection from being sexually abused. And in the class I teach with adults, if we do this name tag game, so they put their name tag on this side and I say, that's right, it's your body. You get to decide where your name tag goes. And then the next week I might say, Shelly, I know you got your name tag on this side, but I'm the teacher and I think you need to move it. So please move your name tag over to the other side. And they immediately move it. And it takes 2 weeks for them to say, no, it's my body. I get to decide. And that's such a great thing to say to yourself all the time. You know, no, it's my body, my life, my time. And I get to decide how I'm going to spend my time, who I'm going to spend my time with, how I'm going to let people touch me, hug me or not. When I feel uncomfortable, you know, this, the talk about your nieces and all of that. If I say, I don't really want to. And then we say, Shelly, you don't want to hurt their feelings. So we're teaching right. that their feelings don't matter and that we have to do things to make sure everybody else is happy. And so we want to start changing that and start talking to young children with disabilities about consent to touch, all kinds of touch. Because what happens too is we start teaching about sexual consent when they're adolescents, but they've never been able to choose whether to hug or not. And then we expect them to be able to speak up in those situations that are much more emotional and lots of feelings involved in them. There was one educator, I think it was Dave Hingsberger, who's a sexuality educator in this field. He's no longer alive, but he said, if they can't choose between peas or carrots, how are they going to be able to choose between sex or not? You know, like that, we've got to give lots of opportunity to make choices and live with your choices, so that we learn how to make decisions for ourselves and make decisions that don't, that we're not taking care of everybody else and their feelings. Like, what are our feelings about this? And it's okay to assert ourselves.
Yeah. And that's another great point. And it is kind of something along the lines that I teach again in that understanding behaviors class, is we have to give children some control. Mm-hmm. Because if they're always being told what to do when they're forced with making their own decisions, they don't know how.
Right.
You know, and it's not that we're, you know, it's simple control. Like, do you want peas or do you want carrots?
Right.
And then, okay, that's what you've chosen. That's what you get. Yeah. And then there's a consequence to that. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's not that you're, and I can already hear some people commenting on this going, you're not a short order cook. No, I'm not a short order cook. But if I have, you know, if I'm at a buffet and there's peas and carrots, I'm not going to put the peas on if they don't want them. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. When you're cooking dinner at home, you're not going to make 5 choices for everything.
Sure.
That's different.
Yeah.
Do you want peas? No. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, then we're going to have to get you some vegetables some other way, you know, or get you the nutrients or whatever. But simple choices, like, do you want to wear the red shirt or the blue shirt?
Right.
Yes. You know, just helping them, because that gives them that little tiny bit of control in a whole world of chaos that they don't often get to make their own choices in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree with you. And yeah, the more opportunity to practice making decisions, the better we get at making decisions as well.
Right. Yeah. And knowing that, you know, oftentimes, like when you're saying peas or carrots or red shirt or blue shirt, that there isn't a wrong answer.
Right.
And I think sometimes we have inadvertently instilled that in our kids, that there's, you know, well, I don't know, because we go back to, well, how's it going to make other people feel?
Mm-hmm.
And therefore it's a wrong answer, because that person's going to be sad that I chose A instead of B.
Right. Right. Yes.
So again, that comes back to all those little conversations and those little experiences.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, go ahead. You first.
Well, I was going to say, and we can start talking, we don't have to wait till puberty. You know, we can start talking about this with young children around bodily autonomy, public and private. What behaviors are public? What behaviors are private? What kinds of relationships do we have in our life? And how do we touch people in different relationships? And body parts as well. What are the medical terms for the sexual parts? It's okay to have... slang words, as long as the young person knows the medical terms in case something happens. It also normalizes the body. It's just a body part, and this is what it's called. And I think, you know, having that knowledge, you do appear educated and you seem less vulnerable as well if you know terminology too. And there was, and this isn't really talking about young children, but there was an older woman in a day program who kept saying, "He keeps touching my purse." And they kept taking her bag and putting it away and thinking that he was grabbing her purse. And 3 weeks later, they realized that it was a slang term for her vagina. And, you know, had she had that language before, she could have said right away what was going on. So, right. You know, so it's good for prevention and normalizing, you know, it's just a body part. And we often as parents feel like if I tell them somehow I'm shattering their innocence. And it's just not true. It will not harm a young child to know their body parts and even to know how babies are made. And they usually ask around 5 or 6 years old. And I know when my child asked, I remember thinking like, oh, I'm shattering their innocence, and told him and off he went. You know, it wasn't, he didn't care. And I was traumatized. And we have to, right. We have to know that it's not going to hurt them. If anything, it's right. To help them.
Yeah. And I think that goes along too with what we mentioned earlier about it has to be developmentally appropriate. Mm-hmm. You know, you can go into all the details and all the medical terms and technical terms, but is that really necessary at age 5 or 6? You know, no, you can just do a very, if that's truly what they're wanting to know, like we said, you ask those questions to try to figure out what the discerning information that you need to give them is, but, you know, then deciding like, okay, do I need to talk about all the parts or do I just kind of a general answer?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. General answers are fine. And as they get older, then they might, you know, puberty, you start talking more about reproduction and the different parts and, So it is age appropriate, medically accurate is really what we want sexuality education to be as well.
Yeah. So earlier we talked about the fact that it, you know, sexuality is part of their self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think just feeling good about yourself, you know, do you have friends? And they make you feel good when you're with them. And, you know, all of those pieces of being a human. And that's part of our sexuality is feeling good about ourselves. Body image is another aspect as well. So I think there's so many ways we can increase our self-esteem. And I think part of it is knowing how to have relationships with people. And so there's a lot of social skills that need to be taught as part of sexuality education. Because you're learning how to make friends and how to keep friends and how to meet if you want a partner later in life. You know, how do you meet someone? And keep the relationship going. And those are skills that a lot of young people with disabilities don't have that much practice at. And sometimes when I do this activity around types of relationships, and then we figure out the different types, and then the individual will talk about who does he or she have in those different categories. And many times someone with a disability has family and a direct support person in their life. And that's it. So how do we make sure that all those categories are filled in, you know, casual friends, acquaintances, coworkers, what's that kind of relationship? And also what's the difference between being friendly and being a friend? Because sometimes that's misread, right? You're really friendly to me. So then I think you're my friend. So then I'm going to tell you really private things because you're my friend. When it's actually just your coworker and they're just being friendly, that we're all very friendly to lots of people.
Right.
It doesn't mean we're friends. So there's a lot of lots of topics to cover too. And like you said, if you can do it gradually over time in little teachable moments, that's the way to do it. And if you're a parent listening and you haven't started, you can start right now. It's okay. And it is nice to make sure they have information about puberty before their bodies change, because that can be really scary if all of a sudden they're bleeding and they don't know why. So I think in that case, we want to make sure people are prepared. But you can do some catch up on some of these topics, like types of relationships and consent and bodily autonomy. Yeah. And I did also want to show another website that is really helpful too. And I'll also show you. Was I sharing this all this time?
Yeah, let's say the consent one. It wasn't up. I mean, it was.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a great website for parents, and it's called amaze.org. And this happens to be, there's many, many different languages that it's, all the different videos are in, but you can go to parents at the top. There's a little tab there. And it gives you guides on how to, you know, talk about it and be an askable parent. And this is for kind of like preteen. And then they even have Amaze Junior, which is for even younger children as well. But if you scroll down, there's lots of different topics. So if you want to talk about puberty with your child, I mean, look at all these, right?
Wow. So
this is good for us to learn the information, but also, you know, we can show pimples and periods, a puberty guide. And if you look at that, it's going to be, there it is. So yeah. So there's videos and they're 2 to 3 minutes and they're animated. But that's a great resource for you to learn. And you can even show your kids some of these videos as well. So that's,
and it's just amaze.com?
.org.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to type that in really quick just so it's here. And it's just Amaze, AMAZE.org.
Yeah, exactly. And they also have things for educators. So if there's any educators listening, they have an educator tab, parents. And so you can see there's lots of different content here to help with learning and teaching. And, you know, maybe we all growing up, maybe we got a book, right? But these are just, right. You know, we're this generation, videos are really a great tool to have to teach.
Yeah, I was just looking at a statistic before we popped on, and it said that our Gen Z population are really into YouTube. That's uh-huh. Of all the social medias, that's their first one. And then TikTok was in there. I think Instagram was second. So YouTube and then Instagram and then TikTok was third. And yeah, so, I mean, the videos are definitely, and the short ones, you know, the shorter, the better. They like them just a couple minutes or, you know, 5 minutes or less.
Exactly.
And so one of the things that we talked about a few minutes ago that I wanted to circle back to is that bodily autonomy for ourselves, but then helping our neurodivergent people truly understand that for other people as well. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking with when you showed the little video, I was thinking about when I taught, and I oftentimes, you know, the kids wanted to come in and hug me, mm-hmm. which I was fine with them hugging me, mm-hmm. but then they would want to go out sometimes and, you know, hug the other adults in the building or other students. And so I had, for some of my students, I couldn't get it across to them, maybe is a better way to put it, that they couldn't just go hug anybody they wanted to. And so we had to stop all hugging because I was always thinking, how is this going to look 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, if we don't teach this now, mm-hmm. and we continue, then it becomes a habit, then it becomes the normal thing to do for everybody.
Right.
And so I wanted to put that out there that we need, you know, that reiterating what you've said, like starting younger, and also just having that idea of what will this look like if I don't talk about this now, mm-hmm. or if I don't instruct now, it's going to be that much harder for my child to understand, but you've let me do it this long. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Fran. She has to go. you know, it's going to be that much harder for my child to understand. Well, it was acceptable. Now, why isn't it? And then it's also harder to stop doing the activity, you know, and hugging is a big one, but that's not the only
Right.
You know,
behavior. Yeah. And I think we want to think about how old is the child biologically, what's the age of the child. And then we want to, sometimes we have to teach some of those nuances in our relationships, right? Like we don't hug strangers, right? We don't even touch strangers at all.
Right.
Right. Not that they're bad people. We just don't touch them. We don't know them well enough. So teaching those different levels of relationships. And like you said, if an 18-year-old who I don't know that does not have a disability tries to hug me, I would be like, whoa, excuse me. I don't know you. But we tend to excuse the behavior of students with disabilities. Like, oh, they didn't mean anything. It's fine. And what we're really doing is we're treating them like children. We're not treating them like we would an 18-year-old. So I'm always saying 18, no matter whether they have a disability or not, they need the same information. And this, you need to be taught the social norms of the culture so that they can fit in and be part of the culture. So if I go and hug people that I don't know, those people are going to start avoiding me.
Right.
Because they're uncomfortable, right? And so then I'm isolated. So we do have to learn some of the rules. It doesn't mean we have to be perfect all the time, but just in general, some of those rules we have to teach because they might be subtly taught and because of the disability may not pick up on those subtleties. So how do we teach concretely different kinds of relationships? And I think that's great that you decided to say, you know, this might be nice now, but 5 years from now, when they're however old and they go up to someone outside of a school, they could get in trouble.
Right.
Yeah.
And especially when we're talking about opposite genders. Mm-hmm. So I interviewed someone a couple months ago now. And he talked about the fact he has autism, and he talked about the fact that he had lost 2 or 3 jobs because at the time, first of all, he didn't know he was autistic, mm-hmm. but he was an affectionate person. Mm-hmm. And so he would stand close to women, or he would, you know, like brush something off of their shoulder, or put his, a couple of things that he said, which when he told me what he said, I didn't take it offensively, but depending on how it was said or, you know, what else was going on, I could see why it would have been that way. And so that's part of what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you address that a little bit?
Yeah. I know that I've done some work with Project Search, which is a job training program. It's a national program. And they reached out to me because people were losing their jobs, not because of their inability to do the job, but because of these social interactions. And so we worked on a curriculum for Project Search. So all the teachers have access to this curriculum around building healthy relationships at work and sort of what's okay at work and how do you interact with your coworkers and how do you say hello and how do you chat at the lunch table. And because now we're in a new environment. We're not in a school where there's a little more protection. Now you're at work. And, you know, you get charged with sexual harassment or different things. So, in all the different environments, we're creating more opportunities. We're getting, you know, no limits for people with disabilities. But then how do we teach young people who are on college campuses they have no education usually, and they're on a college campus now, or they're in a work site. So how do we make sure they're prepared for adult life? And this is an aspect of adult life, is relationships and sexuality.
Yeah. And it was, you know, I hadn't really thought about it until he mentioned that you know, he just a couple of comments that he, oh my goodness, we have to start wrapping up. I didn't realize how much time had gone by. sorry about that. But just the fact that he was standing too close to somebody, you know, he was in their personal space, or he, a couple of comments that he made, or, I, you know, just touching somebody and, you know, just those kinds of things that, you know, when we're training our students, I'm an educational surrogate parent. And so I have a lot of students that I only know on paper and I just have some authority to help with their education. And when I see things like, you know, well, I need to teach them job skills. Yeah, you do. But don't forget the emotional side of the job's skills. Don't forget the interpersonal space skills. You know, when they're talking about, you know, managing a checkbook. Yeah. Okay. But they get money from their job. But if they're interacting inappropriately, they're not going to have that job very long to be able to need to know how to do that checkbook.
Right.
And a checkbook and in general anymore is a whole thing. But
And I think too, we probably have to stop. So I'll stop.
Okay. I do. Oh my gosh, Catherine, this was just amazing. I am so thankful for this conversation. And I really hope that, we had quite a few people watching us live. And so I really hope that, we'll get some great feedback from other people as they watch it in the replay. I do want to pop up your website really quickly, which we didn't even get to show your website. I'm going to try to pop that up just super. Whoops, that's not the one I wanted to do. I was trying to see if I can take that one out and pop yours up really quickly. It is Elevate Us.
Yep.
And it is ELEVATUS training.com. That's how they can find you and they can, what else can they access through your website? Do you have a curriculum that you developed, right?
Yep. There's lots of trainings and curriculum and tools for teaching. But if you go to the resource tab, there's lots of articles and free downloadables and lots of great information for you to talk with your own children or if you're a professional, you know, just some things to consider. So lots of good content there and some lessons as well, like healthy boundaries, that whole topic around the different types of relationships. We have a lesson on there with videos you can use to talk about the different kinds of relationships and how we touch in those relationships.
And you're not in Illinois. I am. And I love that you have something from Illinois. So that means Illinois did something right. oftentimes I don't hear that. So I'm really glad to hear that they have this, the Guardianship and Advocacy Commission on Sexual Rights.
Look around. There's lots of good information there and check out theamaze.org and I think it's great to get resources because we're not used to talking about this. So the more tools we can use and helps us get more comfortable and have these conversations.
And if they wanted to reach out directly to you to be a speaker at an event or maybe come to their school or whatever, they can do that through your website or is there another way?
I'm trying to think. I think it's support@elevatustraining.com or mine is Kath, K-A-T-H. @elevatus.com, my email. So if someone wanted to reach out to me.
Yep. Awesome. Again, thank you. So I'm going to try to see if I can type this in here really fast. Elevatus.com. Kath at Elevatus. Oh, was it Elevatus Training?
Yes.
I just put Elevatus. Oh, shoot. Okay.
That's okay.
I'll have to fix it. Elevatus Training. So,
yes.
But again, thank you. I mean, I'm blown away at how quickly that time went today. It is such a large topic.
Yes.
And there are so many nuances that if the audience, if you want me to have her back so that we can talk about more things, please be sure to reach out to me and let me know because I do think this is, again, it's an uncomfortable topic. But it is such an important topic, whether you have a neurotypically developing or a neurodivergent developing child and adult, to always have those conversations. The examples you gave of, you know, talk about when you watch a television program or a movie and there's a relationship in there, talk about some things about that relationship with your child and have those little mini conversations so that when you do have the talk, it's not such a big daunting thing that's so uncomfortable for everybody. Thank you again so much for being my guest today. I will see everybody else next week. Have a great week, everybody.
Hey, Hey, parents and teachers, are you tired of IEP meetings that feel like a battle? Let's put an end to the tension and create a collaborative, calm, and respectful environment together. Shelly Kino, your go-to IEP consultant, can transform your meetings into positive and productive experiences. With Shelly Kino, your child is her top priority, your voice is heard, and you become confident. Shelly Kino is making the world better for all, one IEP at a time. Visit www.shellykino.com for more information and set up your free 20-minute consultation today. That's shellykino.com, S-H-E-L-L-E-Y-K-E-N-O-W.